welcome to another edition of Spanning Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. I just got some good news in the email box. I used to review records for a living, and so I used to get tons of music for free, LPs, and then tons of CDs, and nowadays I just get kind of announcements in email and occasional URLs to list the free music. But I did get an announcement recently. They're going to that Southern Lord, the great metal label, Smart Metal Label, is going to put out a final, complete, absolutely perfecto vision of one of the most classic recordings in the stoner metal subgenre, Sleeps Dope Smoker. AKA, also known as Jerusalem. There have been many records that this song, which isn't even really a song, it's kind of like tapping into a certain current in the telluric fields of the earth. It's this immense, endless riff that barely deviates for over an hour with some kind of cool, scary singing, and it's a classic. And one of the versions of the record that I have, the TP edition, has an awesome cover by our guest today, Eric Roper, a well-renowned artist touching into genres of psychedelia, metal mysticism, sci-fi spookiness, and an all-around ambient vibe of enchantment and wonderful weirdness. And he also is going to do the cover on the new record, which is a different image, and shows his continuing obsession with Dune, which we'll have to ask him about. But in any case, we're going to revel in our pop culture fascinations of this show. And if you have never heard this Sleep record, please check it out, because it really is kind of like nothing else out there. So, with that, we'll bring on our co-host, also a metalhead of sorts, Maja Dau. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. I'm feeling pretty good today. I got my tea. One of my fellow students here gave me some delicious Tulsi green tea that is refreshing and rejuvenating. And
it's doing cute. Magic. It's like giving you an apple or something.
Exactly. It was very very kind kind of gesture. But, yeah, I know you're psyched about talking to Eric today, because you are also a fan of this of these tunes. What's the last metal show you saw?
Oh, well, actually, funnily enough, apart from my friends' bands, which are metal, I would say, funnily enough, the last one I think I saw was High on Fire, which I believe Eric did a cover for. So
That's true. It's
the circle of life, man.
And how were they?
They were pretty good, I gotta say. Like, I thought they were pretty dude-styled out, but it was good. I liked it. It was a good show.
Yeah, it can be pretty dude.
There was a lot of dudes in the audience. I think I was one of maybe five girls, so.
Well, you know, one of the things about metal that people, you know, I often meet people who are kind of surprised that I, like, you know, unironically, genuinely love metal and have since I was 14 and go to shows and stuff like that, is that even though it's like, it sounds like really serious heavy music a lot of the time, and sometimes it really is serious heavy music, is that the shows are like, people are there to have a good time. They want to have fun. It's not like an indie rock show where you go there. I was just at South by Southwest, and it's like I go to the indie ones, and everyone's just all like, you know, they're tweeting, and they're just like kind of hanging back with their arms crossed, with their like plaid sweaters and stuff. And then you go to the metal shows, and they're just like, just drinking beer and having a good time.
Heshers go to the shows for the music, and they want to get their, like, souls stirred from deep under the ground. You're so right. Like, the indie rockers, I mean, they're like, they like it or whatever, but they're too mopey to really get that, like, riled up. But Yeah, the metal dudes are very dedicated to the music itself.
It is something about getting that soul juice. And that's what comes through in Roper's art. That's one of the reasons it makes sense that he does this stuff. So with no further ado, let's bring Eric onto the show. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Eric.
Yeah, say, hey, you're copying me.
Okay, no more echoes.
No more echoes. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Mind.
And I just want to let people know, if you're just kind of listening to the show idly and haven't seen Eric's work, you can go to his website, ericroper.com, and so you can check out some of the stuff and make a little more sense with the kinds of things we're talking about. It's always nice to start, with a little bit kind of a story, a kind of a little biographical scenario. And, one of the things looking at your work, which is very specific, it's unique, it's your voice, and it also resonates, I think, for a lot of people with a lot of, it's a sense of familiarity that's a little bit hard to pin down. It's like, oh, I've seen, it's almost like I saw this when I was a kid in some, on some, comic book, but I can't remember it, and maybe I dreamed about it, or it was the gatefold of this record that I don't really, and it's just, it has this really rich sense of memory and definitely drawing from some stuff in the 70s, but also a really strong element of nature stuff in it. And I just can't help but imagine that some of that doesn't have to do with your own upbringing. I mean, your middle name, after all, is Moonhawk. I mean, the real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, that is a real middle name, by the way. I've somehow along the way, people started putting it in quotes. I don't know where, but I've seen it listed online in quotes a couple times, and that's incorrect. I mean, I wouldn't come up with a moniker like that for myself. That sounds kind of pretentious, but that is actually my middle name. And that, I guess, is significant because it sort of gives you an idea of the environment that I came into. When your parents choose a name like that for yourself, you can probably assume that there's some other things about them that are, a little creative and nurturing to the arts and so forth. And both my parents were, and I guess still are, artists. My mother's an illustrator. And I picked up a lot from them. And my dad was also really into, films and comics, underground comics and science fiction, fantasy, that sort of stuff. So I got exposed to it all when I was very young, and it was just kind of a part of my environment. And
yeah,
it was just encouraged.
Because you're born in 1973, and, I'm older than you. I was about six that year. And I know that a lot of, the reason your work works for me is because, as I said, it does remind me, it resonates with that particular era in a certain way. I mean, it's also very fresh, so it's not retro, but it just resonates with that stuff. And we've talked about a lot of that. I mean, we like a lot of stuff from the 70s, bands from the 70s and comics and stuff like that. But it's almost like you're kind of younger in a way. You didn't grow up like you just imbibed it directly from from the DNA, from the spores in the air. I mean, you were in the 80s by the time you were really paying attention. So I'm curious about that. Is there a way you I know we talked about this before, and you have maybe a different way of thinking about it than I do, with maybe less historical. But what is it about that era, the time when you were brought into this world, 1973, that whole kind of zone? There's something there that I think people still really, really respond to them. You see it also all over pop culture today and have for a long time. So
yeah, a friend of mine, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
A friend of mine
put it this way. He said that, he's about 9 years older than me. He was born in 64. And he was, well aware of what was happening in the 70s. And in his opinion, he thinks that 1973 was kind of like the crystallization of when the real psychedelic mind met with pop culture. Dark Side of the Moon came out in 73. That sort of epitomized that very concept in a way. You've got a pop album that's also one of the most incredible psychedelic albums in existence if you care to, you know, put on the headphones and treat it that way. But it can also be something you can probably listen to with your grandmother if it came down to it. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe that's when the undercurrent of what was happening throughout the late 60s and early 70s kind of broke the surface into the mainstream, and everything became very colorful, very, you know, pop psychedelia, Lava Lamps, all this kind of stuff. That, I know it was around before that, but maybe you could speak about that yourself since you recall. But I mean, I even caught it when I was 5 and 6 years old in the late 70s. It hung around for a while. It wasn't like today where stuff changes so quickly.
Did you go through your dad's, like, comics and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I saw that stuff at probably too young of an age.
It's so funny because, like, you know, I was born in 1974, which that was the year that Philip K. Dick had his crazy experience. And my mom was an artist, too, and she had, like, all those, like, crazy books around, too, and I saw them at a very young age. I think there was something about taking in that unadulterated psychedelia, like, as a kid, it really, like, kind of affected my brain a little bit, I think, and made it think different than other people. So seeing those kind of comics and that kind of art and that kind of music, like, when you're a kid, I mean, I feel like it did. It kind of produced this, like, specific effect.
Yeah, it was a great time to be that age, actually. You know, being 3 years old in 1976, the children's entertainment that was around was really, really heady.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the cartoons and Sesame Street and even the kids' music, it was really kind of profound and progressive, you know, feminism and Free to Be You and Me and all
the
Marlon Thomas
remember
stuff.
Free to You and Me.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is what they were playing for us in preschool. And it was political in a way, you know, like they were changing things. Boundaries were dissolving. And nowadays, all that stuff has been taken for granted. You know, it does sound dated when you hear about a song about a mother having a right to have a job or something like that,
right,
from that album. But the point is, it was kind of a radical time, and I feel like that just seeped in, and it became a part of my early childhood. And then even when I was 5 and 6 in the late 70s, you know, stuff was changing. But, you know, I would still spend time in the blacklight store in the mall when I was 6 years old, and I still got to see all that stuff. And it was just, I mean, it couldn't have been more entertaining for a child.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like,
I mean,
exactly
we
what you want to see.
Listeners of the show will remember we had Peter Berbergall on to talk about his book, Too Much to Dream. And he's about my age. And the point he made, which I never really quite put together, even though it's really obvious, was that pop culture of that era, of the you know, early to late 70s, that kind of head stuff, it's like, it's not just that the underground is popping up. It's just the people who are just actually producing it are heads. So it's like they're going to put jokes in. So like, even if you're like doing mainstream superhero comics, you're going to make it a little bit edgier. You know, your visuals are a little bit swimmier. You're going to have a little bit more making kids shows. You're doing, you know, marketing for McDonald's, for Christ's sake. You look at that H.R. Puffin stuff that they then, you know, McDonald's ripped off for its ads, and it's completely bizarre. So it's like the whole culture is saturated with a certain kind of, like, psychedelic mysticism that is just, you know, pervasive in the pop culture. And then you're a kid and you're just taking in the pop culture. You're not taking in the drugs. You're just like, wow, what's this? And it sets in motion, you know, a certain kind of set of associations, just the way, like, you know, children's illustrations do anyway. You know, you look at children's illustrations, you kind of open up this world of wonder that you kind of remember when you were a kid, that one time in the field, and you can't remember, is it a real memory or a dream, you know, that sense, except it's all mixed up with all this, like, super heavy, like, weird head comic books and things like that, that is such a delicious flavor, if nothing else. I mean, I think it also has a political and spiritual resonance. And one of them that I wanted to, you know, bring up in terms of your work is a certain kind of playful way with darkness, you know, with a sense of foreboding or heaviness or sinister or mythic or, you know, a certain kind of way of framing it that's not, like, too ponderous, but still, like, you know, this isn't, like, happy, fluffy land. you know, and I can keep that with a lot of your kind of images. So I was just wondering if you had a kind of sense of that in terms of the things you get, you're drawn to, or the kind of emotional ambiance of some of the things that you do.
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in, you know, I guess you could say dark things, but not dark in a necessarily negative way. I just find it's more like mystery. I find mystery to be very intriguing, you know, things that are not shown but hinted at are more more fascinating, leaving something to the imagination. It was never a conscious effort to do that sort of thing with my illustrations, but I have noticed that as a theme when I look back on stuff and other people pointed out that there's kind of like this darkness to it, but it's not dominating it. And it's also not really intentional. You know, there's a lot of people who do art, especially in the field that I work in a lot with, record covers and, you know, the metal category, where it's just so obviously, you know, dark, 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 and getting hit over the head with darkness and just, you know, like gore and swords and just mayhem and negativity. And, you know, that's easy to do. And it doesn't have a lot of soul, in my opinion, you know, most of the time. It's obvious. It's kind of like the difference between watching The Shining and watching, you know, some overt slasher movie that just, you know, there's nothing to it. It's just too out in the open and it's boring. So, I mean, that's something that I never did and really intend, but it's true that it is something that I think is adds to it, at least. You know, I had a lot of dreams that kind of have played into my artwork when I was younger, like these kind of very mysterious, almost ominous dreams. A lot of the daydreaming I've done throughout my childhood seems to have this kind of like mystery. When I was a child, I had these dreams of crossing through boundaries into other lands, and they would happen at the corner of a room where two walls met. And you would kind of enter this other dimension through the walls, and also like where the horizon of the sea meets the sky on the ocean. There was this kind of breaking through between the cracks of something into another dimension, and you know, something beyond and something that you don't see but is there has always been present in my dreams, and I guess in my artwork as well.
Do you still have crazy dreams like that, or were they mostly only when you were a kid?
They were mostly when I was a kid. I mean, these days, I feel like a lot of my dreams are about more mundane, but every once in a while, there's something like that. I've never forgotten it, so, you know, it's still really with me, but I don't recall having anything that literally the way I described in a while.
Are you aware of, like, kind of consciously cultivating the memory and the sort of sense of connection to your earlier self and the kinds of experiences you have then, or is it just something that just comes natural, like you just have these experiences, they marked you, they're part of you, you don't even have to kind of worry about it?
It's not conscious, it just kind of happens that way. You know, I basically have always just drawn what I wanted to draw, and you know, people like it or they don't. And I sort of, you know, when I got old enough to realize that there was such a thing as lowbrow art and that fantasy art was considered lowbrow to some people and comic book art was considered lowbrow, you know, by that point I was already really into it and I could draw well. And I was like, you know, I wasn't a geek. I wasn't in the closet. I mean, I was a geek in the sense I was geeking out on stuff, but I wasn't like one of these people who was socially inept, is what I'm saying. I didn't have to use comics to escape and have a life. You know, I was active, I had friends and all that. So it wasn't, I was very confident about drawing this stuff. I was like, you know, I'm going to draw fantasy stuff, and if you don't like it, then, you know, who gives a shit? You know, this is what I like to do, and I'll keep doing it. And I did it through high school and college, which was, you know, I was in classes with cartooning people, and that was kind of a trial to be in cartooning school because it was, you know, classes with only guys and just really nerdy kind of intense comic book stuff. But I just did what I liked to do, and I felt like it kind of finally people came around and were just like, hey, this guy really likes doing this stuff, and he's good at it. And then in pop culture now, it's kind of turned to where that stuff has become popular again, you know? People have embraced metal, which along with it goes all this, you know, the sorts of themes we're talking about. So, you know, there was
well,
no
and that's interesting too. If I mean, because when we talked to one of the guys from Wolves in the Throne Room, and we're talking about how metal inextricably always seems bound with the forest and with mythologies and these kind of epic sagas. You know, what for you personally with like kind of being drawn to that type of mythos in art and with the metal kind of situation. I mean, what's your relationship like with some of the older mythology story type of stuff? Are you very familiar with a lot of that? Does that feed your art at all?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I love the mythology, you know, Norse mythology, Egyptian history and mythology, if you can call it that, Middle Eastern history and mythology as well, European, all of that stuff I'm immensely interested in, and it does inform it because, you know, it's influential in its ideas. I feel like that kind of stuff is just, it's just food for the brain, you know. That is really such a well of ideas, this mythology that humans have built up through different cultures. It's like, if you can tap into that, it's just like, it's almost like the new sphere of imagination that we've created here on Earth is mythology and religion. It's something that's not tangible, but it's out there, and it's a part of, you know, most of us. So, yeah, and,
yeah,
and I have
one
read
of the
a
things
lot of
I like about. I mean, one of the reasons like mythology is attractive, and you know, one of the elements of what makes like lowbrow art lowbrow, or makes illustration as opposed to quote unquote art, is that it's drawing from a common pool. You know, both mythology is about archetypes. It's about images that reverberate in many different stories, sometimes from all over the world in different ways. You know, there's the wise old man, and there's the trickster character, and these sort of figures. They make themselves known through lots of different incarnations, which is kind of the way that like genre works. It's the way that like, you know, like there's a bunch of kinds of images you associate with like heavy metal art, and a lot, most of it is really easy and really repetitive and is not interesting, you know. It just sort of is like a badge. But there's something also about the return to these images that when it's done well, either in, you know, as with a rich sense of history or ambiguity or mystery, then it really punches sometimes precisely because it is like an archetype. So like, you know, your wolves are, you know, they're intense. They're not just like, you know, there's a lot of wolves in band album covers and names.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when it's
cool.
Done well, what's that?
I said, because wolves are cool.
Because wolves are cool. I mean, they are just kind of just generic. You know, I mean, they're just kind of cool when almost any way you slice the situation. But that's part of the, like, play. It's like you want to make things, like, that they resonate. You can recognize these figures. But if you can identify them too crisply, then you kind of lose some of the mystery. So there's somewhere in between, like, and that's where that mystery places. It's about ambiguity, not quite clear what it is, and yet you recognize something, and it draws you like, huh, I've seen this guy before. Is this from something? You know, and so that's, I think, a really, you know, key element about that. But that's really, I see it, and maybe I'm not as exposed to much, but I, you know, I look at a lot of, you know, popular art and lowbrow art, and I keep, you know, looking at album covers and, you know, comic book stuff, and yeah, there's a lot of powerful stuff out there, but there's not that many people for me who really work in that kind of that sense of mystery, that sense of this kind of ambiguity. And I don't know, is that something that does that reflect probably the way you you know, experience life or think about the world or the experiences you've had in nature or whatever, or is it just in some ways you're just a good artist, and you figured out how to, like, do this in a certain way that, you know, works for a weirdo like me?
Yeah. Well, it's probably a little of both. I grew up in the country of Virginia from, you know, like, half my life as I was growing up as a kid, and spent a lot of time in the woods. I also lived in Alaska in a pretty remote area when I was young with my parents. Spent a long time by myself drawing every day, as well as out in the woods exploring. And although I was fascinated by nature, I feel like it's such an incredible tool for inspiration, you know, because everything exists in nature. And if you can learn how to understand how shapes in nature occur, then you can pretty much bring that into art and understand how everything works. You know, there's patterns in nature, there's shapes, and studying those things will help you to understand almost anything you want to draw, I feel. So, you know, I feel like that stuff was obviously big for me. And I always felt like I would rather depict that than things like cars. I was never into drawing cars and, you know, sports stuff and things like that, which a lot of people did go through phases of that sort of thing.
Dudes, like in my art classes, like in school, there's always the dudes that draw like the airplanes and the cars, and like whenever guys get into drawing, it tends to go in that direction a lot of
times.
Yeah,
I know. Did you have
other dude friends that were drawing this kind of stuff, or was it just you?
It was just me. I mean, there was nobody I knew. I was doing this at a very young age, and I would say that I was really good at it at a young age too, and I didn't really have any peers who were anywhere close to what I was doing. You know, I don't have another way to put it without sounding, you know, smug. I'm not trying to sound like that at all, but I was always kind of on my own page, so to speak. I didn't have anybody who was doing this with me or was as good at it. I mean, I don't think that now. I mean, there's tons of guys out there now who are just incredible. It's kind of like the scene is just like growing exponentially, and people are kind of... That's another thing. It's like the trends in illustration. This is a whole other topic we could go on, but I feel like, especially in the genre we've been talking about, people latch on to ideas they see from influential artists, and then they kind of start making clones of that, and then it kind of evolves into something else, and then people start cloning that. You know, right now, as you said, wolves are hot. A couple of years ago, it was owls. The pushead revival is just out of hand. I feel like it needs to stop.
The leash revival?
The pushead revival.
That illustrator for Metallica.
Yeah, pushead. Eric knows pushead.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. I mean, but in this category of, you know, underground art and music art, there's just so much pushead copying going on, and that's a good example of something that's it's kind of growing and changing, but it's a real meme right now. And I try not to do the sorts of things that everybody does. It's not really a conscious decision, but I think it if I felt like I was, and I would probably steer away from something like that. But you know, getting back to the natural influences, I feel like it was just always there. It's just something that that I find inspiring personally. You know, people have different things that inspire them.
Did you ever have an experience you remember when you were like really struck by something in the natural world? Did you ever have any, you know, whatever, either spooky moonlight things or just stuff that sticks with you?
Oh yeah, I'm trying to think of some. Well, I mean, nothing overly dramatic, but when I was in Alaska, it was pretty striking because the landscape there is just really incredible. You know, it's like Lord of the Rings, and I was surrounded by moss-covered trees and glaciers and huge mushrooms. My mother got into collecting mushrooms while we were there, and she would bring home these huge dry mushrooms, and she would draw them herself. And I remember that as being a really cool thing that I liked, and you know, twisted trees and stuff like that. We kind of had this stuff around the house a lot, so I would say that Alaska for me was just monumentally huge for my development because it hit me at a young age. I was like 3 and 4 at that time. And,
oh my God, that's amazing. Well, also just that it's also brought into the home that you have a model through your mom in this case of like someone who's like, it's not just like something you go out and go, wow. It's like you can actually engage it and then bring it into the home and bring it into, you know, your own hand. And you know, that's like, so it's not even just about, you know, it's about the whole thing, the whole environment, not just the outside environment, too. It's a really remarkable experience. But we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and talk probably more about mushrooms and other things. You're listening to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Eric Roper, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, speaking with Eric Roper about art and metal and nature. The three are total soul bros. And before the break, you were mentioning about mushrooms a little bit, and I was curious about your mushroom book that you did. And mushrooms, to me, always carry this epic spot because they really are portals, like it or not. As a kid, I was very overtaken by fairies and mushrooms and art, and since I grew up in the Pacific Northwest up by, you know, Seattle on this little island, there was just mushrooms all over the place. And in college, I took a mushroom class and got to see all the different kinds. But they really, like, throughout history, it seems like mushrooms kind of have their foot in all kinds of crazy mythos. Like, if it's Soma with, you know, all the Indian stuff, or, you know, the psychedelic stuff, but even the non-psychedelic species seem to worm their way into a lot of this culture. Was for you, was a lot of the inspiration from your mushroom book, did that come just from your mom, or were there other kinds of things that led into it?
It was much more than that. That the book Mushroom Magic was something that an editor at Abrams Books and myself developed together. It was kind of proposed to me, and she asked if I'd be interested in doing it as my book. And of course, I said yes because I, you know, had always wanted to do that. I agree, mushrooms do have this kind of this mythic quality to them, probably because they're poisonous. A lot of them are poisonous, and throughout history, they've always been feared. And, I don't know if you could say they were feared and admired, because I don't even really think they were admired, except for a few individuals who figured out, you know, what else you can do with them.
Mm.
But
and medicine-wise, too. I mean, they're also medicine on the other end of it. So,
sure, yeah. They're extremely healthy, if you know which ones to work with. So they're this kind of double-edged sword where, you know, you can eat one and die a horrible death, or it can make you extremely healthy, or it can be a spiritual experience. And, you know, that's kind of a unique position in the animal kingdom for something to occupy.
Yeah, and it's like they're not animals, they're not plants. They have their own even, like, crazy category. They're total aliens.
Yeah. Another great thing about them, they have more in common with humans animals than plants, from what I understand. You know, they're closer in biological makeup to mammals than plants. And they seem to be an intelligent species in a lot of ways, too, the way they operate. You know, they can take waste and turn it into food. They can proliferate like nothing else. They have short life cycles. They make the best out of anything. And I think there's a real metaphor in there.
And isn't, like, the oldest species that we know of on the planet, isn't it that, like, interconnected fungus underground or whatever?
Yeah, I don't think that's oldest.
I think it's like 10,000 years old or something.
Oh, I'm not sure. I don't know how old it is, but it's the largest.
The biggest, maybe.
Yeah, by far. I mean, you know, there's no living thing that's as large as that. And is that in Washington State? I think it is.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but just that alone, just the whole, like, you know, the mycelium, you know, Paul Stamets talks about it, like, the sort of, you know, it's like the internet of the organic world, where it's just this immensely complex, decentralized network, you know. And then one of the things that I wrote a foreword for Eric's book, and one of the things I talked about was also just how the mushroom itself is about concealing and revealing. I mean, it's like the ultimate esoteric plant, because it's like, you don't see them. And then, like, one morning, there they are. and they're all popped up. And of course, with the mushrooms, we know that's just they're just like the little periscopes of the submarine mycelial networks that exist all the time, but we don't see them. So it's like they play this game of hide and seek. And then when I was doing research for this, it was so much fun to, you know, to research this. You know, I just went back and I started looking at the history of like the natural scientists who would draw mushrooms. You know, that was like, you know, there were all these natural scientists and proto-scientist guys who were out there drawing different species. You know, everything got drawn. But there's something about these mushroom drawings that are weird because they have this magical illustrated quality. I mean, that they're demanding of the artist's sort of imagination as much as their ability to kind of just capture something in the wild. And so you can almost see these books as though, even though they were being, you know, they're books of natural history, they're just trying to do good science and describe what exists in the world, they're totally hallucinatory and dreamlike. So there's something very, even just the, like you were asking before, but even, you know, non-psychoactive mushrooms, just the way that they feature in our imaginations and the way we draw them and the way we bring them into, you know, human culture, it's always just got this air of weirdness to it. It's irreducible. But how long did that project take you? I mean, you had, what, you know, 150 images in that book of psychedelic mushrooms?
Yeah, well, that was the first book I had ever done, and I didn't have a lot of experience in the publishing world. But they allowed lots of time for every step of the process except for the part where I had to make the artwork. You know, like, they take their time writing up the contract. They take their time calling me back. They take their time getting to the meetings. But as soon as it's time for the artwork, they're like, could you get that to me in 6 weeks? So I did all of that in 6 weeks.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Whoa.
Yeah, I was doing two a day. And it was intense. It was just, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to... I was, you know, sure to make them look as nice as I could, and I didn't skimp on them, but it was just like I had to be on a serious schedule, and it'd be nice to have more leisurely pace, but as I said, you know, I took the deadline seriously, so I got it done on time, and then, of course, after that, it took them 6 months to lay it out.
Of course.
They've given
but they
me a little
did a great
more time.
I mean, that was a nice thing about that book, too. I mean, it was really a class act from beginning to end, that the design and the layout and the feel of the book, and it kind of reminded me of some of those books from the 70s, like, you know, the gnomes books and stuff like that, where it had this sort of feel, being it's like wasn't quite, you know, totally contemporary style, had a little bit of this sort of memory of those kind of more, you know, magical illustrated books, you know, back in the day. But one of the questions I had about your work there is just about watercolor. Is there a lot of watercolor in your work, or is that something that you found, you know, more recently? Or, you know, if I went back through all the album covers, I'd go, oh yeah, this is actually half of this is watercolor.
Pretty much everything in the past 10 years has been watercolor. Before that, I was using permanent markers and India ink, and that was hard to maintain. You know, the fumes and it's not a pleasant process having to use permanent markers. I didn't use a computer at all. I didn't even have a computer back then. So pretty much everything in the past 10 years that you would have seen, I've done in watercolor, if it's color. It's just now for me that's my preferred thing. I just like it a lot. I kind of treat it as inks. I use these P.H. Martin's permanent liquid inks, which can be called watercolors, I guess, or inks, because you can mix them and dilute them, and they spread like watercolors. But I just get a lot of satisfaction out of the way these things soak into the paper, and the colors are so vibrant.
I love the package, too. It's like it's all set up so neat and tidy with the little droppers, and they're just so neat.
Yeah, they look like a chemistry set.
It's like a science kit, really.
Yeah, they're really fun to look at, too.
Well, you mentioned the computer, so do you, how about that? I mean, I know you've been exploring, you know, animation programs and things like that. You're you know, broadening your palette, but how is it, did it take a while for you to sort of you know, embrace the computer, or in what way are you thinking about using it in terms of your evolving interests?
Well, I use it a lot in the sense that I use it to lay things out. Sometimes I'll do things in layers, even if it's in watercolor. I'll do a foreground separately from a background, or especially if I'm doing a poster or something where there needs to be a lot of text, I'll do things in layers because it allows the opportunity to change later. Whereas if everything is on one layer, then you're kind of screwed if you have to make serious changes. So I learned that from just doing commercial art, that there's always something that could change later. So I sort of approached Photoshop with a silkscreener's mentality, because I did screen printing in college at SVA, and I sort of treated it like that. I was never really interested in making art in Illustrator, that kind of, you know, synthetic airbrush look. But instead, I use it to just kind of compose and put things together and change opacity and saturation and things like that. And for that, I find it really, really invaluable, and I can achieve some really incredible things with it that way. But it's not obvious, you know. It's not like somebody would really even think that it was ever done, because it's done from organic elements. I just kind of put them together and create new organic elements digitally with it. I recently did just try some experimentation with Photoshop painting in Photoshop, just from scratch, you know, not scanning at all, but just doing a painting in Photoshop. And it's too easy. It's just too easy. I almost don't like it, you know. I was like, this is too much of a breeze. I mean, I can just do anything I want, which is cool, but something about it, it feels like a shortcut, but, you know, it's not a reason not to do it, I guess. I'll probably get more into experimenting with that later on.
Well, I mean, but that's a really, really interesting point. I mean, it really gets down to some basic issues of, like, yeah, I mean, you got a career now, you got a kid, you know, you got to keep it working. But at the same time, you're here for very deep reasons. And, you know, you're like, someone's like, well, so what? What do you mean? It takes you less time? Great. Make more art. You know, like, just make more images. Get into it. And yet, clearly there's something about the process, the physicality, the time alone, that is part of what the experience is for you. And I'm curious, do you feel like you might actually lose something by going down that easy road in terms of your art? Or is it more just that you just don't enjoy it as much?
I think something's lost, yeah. Well, for one thing, it doesn't look the same, you know. You can't match that look of the color soaked into the fiber of paper or canvas, you know. You can never really recreate that on the computer. And that's okay, because there's different styles to work with, and there's things I do on the computer that look really, you know, glossy and you know, if I treat it, you know, as if I'm using an airbrush, I can do some really incredible stuff with it. And I love the way it looks. And, you know, I can do, like, shiny metallic logos and all kinds of stuff like that, which I wouldn't do on paper just because I can't use an airbrush in my apartment here in New York. So I can do that in Photoshop, and I can also make it look pretty analog still. It doesn't look like, you know, a synthetic piece of glass or something. It looks like it's got some soul to it. But, you know, I wouldn't try to replicate a lot of the stuff that I do, I don't think, because something does get lost, in my opinion. But I don't know, you know, I've seen some stuff in Photoshop that looks really great, but, I guess the process is more important to me than I realize sometimes, even though it can be really tedious.
Yeah, that's a good insight, though. That's because people can go, you know, get off base by forgetting the process side. I wanted to ask you something else about the kind of content stuff. Is, like, you know, one of the nice tensions in your work, I think, is that there's a way in which you have one foot in a kind of fantasy world and one foot in a science fictional one. And some of your images, like, they really blur, like, you're not really sure, is this, like, the future, is this, like, the past, is it, like, you know, and I think about the image that I mentioned before about, you know, the stuff you've drawn from Dune, and that kind of landscape, which is sort of like both and or whatever. Do you feel like you're going to be moving in more in one direction or another? Are you drawn towards being more, you know, explicitly science fiction illustrator, you know, even if you imagine doing, you know, animations or posters or whatever? Or are you, like, kind of, you know, happy with this tension, you know, between these worlds?
Oh, I love it all. You know, in some ways I feel like they're the same thing. I really like the idea of something that looks like it's from the past being the future. You know, it's kind of implying this cycle where things come back to where they were at another point in the past. That being said, I kind of gravitate more towards science fiction philosophically. I enjoy reading science fiction more than I do fantasy a lot more. I think the ideas are a bit more, progressive, for lack of a better word, because they're in the, you know, it's, they're kind of more mind expanding. The possibilities are limitless, and I gravitate more towards science fiction in that sense. But I don't really find a difference in the two when it comes to doing artwork, because I feel like they're kind of interchangeable in the way I think of them.
Speaking of philosophy and ideas, I was just curious, I know you mentioned like kind of religion and mythos feeding some of your art earlier. Do you have a particular kind of religious practice that you follow? You know, have you ever kind of gotten interested in any of the paganistic traditions or anything like that?
Well, very interested in a lot of things. I've never practiced any one thing. I was never a church goer, my grandparents were Christian, and I went to church with them sometimes. My parents didn't go to church. So I learned a little bit of the kind of, you know, mainstream Christianity as I was growing up. But on my own, I've researched Christianity. I find that pretty fascinating, the idea of Jesus and the Christ and the Messiah myth. And Hindu mythology is endlessly fascinating because it's so psychedelic and just bizarre, and also seems to have a lot of real truths in it, and almost like science. It's just kind of all dressed up in this cartoon of deities and things, rituals, and it's very elaborate, but I feel like there's a lot of core truths there that they get right. But you know, I guess there've been, meditation is something that I've done on and off in my life, but I wouldn't consider that a religious thing. I'm interested in a lot, but I've never really practiced anything. I don't think I could join a religion. You know, I couldn't really become a part of that because I'm just too interested in all of them.
Mm.
You know, I find that the pagan stuff is obviously really fascinating, too.
Yeah, that's a big thing Eric and I talk about a lot, too, just the whole culture joiner thing and how, I mean, there's just way too much kind of different overlap in ideas that we kind of find, and it prevents, you know, a total amalgamation with any single one. I don't know. What do you think that is, Eric? Like, people like us that kind of can't get into a single one, you know?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's sometimes it seems like an advancement, and sometimes it seems like a fallback. Like there's something about structures, about the way that people, you know, kind of stop thinking when they cohere as a group and groupthink, and then you have authorities and the person over this, and then people struggling to get up the ladder, and those things happen everywhere. Even if the master at the core of the thing is enlightened, it doesn't matter because there's still squabbling about, you know, who's doing the dishes, you know, at the same time as the master sitting there being enlightened. You know, it's like there's just something about these structures that some of us don't work out well, and probably because we want to keep that larger view, but then you're kind of, there's sometimes you're on your own and there's no ground and there's not really a community in the same way. You know, I think that the big challenge for people who don't find their way into a tradition is that you have to figure out a more subtle way of being in community and knowing that sometimes you won't be in community. And that's the great thing. It's like you've committed to a practice, you go to a place, you go to a Zen center, whatever it is. It's like when you go through a rough patch, there's a structure there, and in some sense, that's it's designed for that. You know, it's one of the healthy things that it can do is, you know, keep people going when things go rough, you know, existentially as well as just, you know, in your life if you get a disease or something like that. But if you're kind of more on your own, then it's like that net safety net's not really there in the same way. But it also makes the relationships that people make who are more in that world, I think, sometimes more, you know, there's a richness to them precisely because you don't really have that shared matrix. So I know when I think about my, you know, quote-unquote spiritual community, it's just like all my friends.
Yeah, and, me too. Do you have that too, like, Eric?
Yeah, of course. I that's exactly what it is, you know. It seems like a lot of, you know, religions, if you call it that, are sort of support groups. You know, you need people who think like you. You need to feel like you belong, and that's okay. But personally, and, you know, probably with you guys as well, I find it more interesting to kind of find things out myself. And fortunately, I've got friends who share that attitude, and, you know, I feel like we kind of, you know, we've got that community ourselves, and I'm not lonely. You know, I don't feel like I'm missing out by handing over my, you know, my belief or something to someone who's going to tell me, you know, that what is going on. It feels very repellent to me to kind of, you know, to have someone else tell me what's going on when they're in a situation where they couldn't possibly know more than I do anyway.
Yeah, they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
That's the bottom line. It's like, you know, why would they know? You know, this, we're all in this together. But yeah, I do have friends who I can share this kind of stuff with, and that makes a big difference. It's probably a lot harder if you're the only one, especially.
Well,
if you're
surrounded. Well, and for you, does that happen in music? And like, I mean, I know we mentioned that you do art for some stuff, but you were actually in bands before too. I mean, were any of those kind of formulated around religion and philosophy ideas?
Yeah, if you count. Playing music, playing the same song for 2 hours of philosophy. philosophy was improv,
like a ritual of sorts.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was kind of like that. You know, we didn't take it seriously, but that was our thing. It was like we did have our format was that there was no format, and it came to the point where we wouldn't write songs, which gets kind of old in itself too. You know, I feel like a balance is kind of ideal, but I've been in different types of bands where there were songs and entirely different philosophies. But you know, music is kind of everything. Art and music is everything to me, and I feel like that right there is kind of all I would really need. It's just playing music feels like living. You know, I feel like that is a fine replacement, as if I needed one, for, you know, some sort of spiritual practice, because it is spiritual. It's completely elevating and transcendental. So that was kind of the only thing that I would say was the philosophy behind it. It's just that we all really love music, and we think that it is what life is.
Well, you know, I think we're going to have to wrap things up there, of course, because all that applies to art making as well. So thanks so much for talking with us today, Eric.
It was great. I wish we could do it longer.
Yeah, and so, yeah, folks, go again, ericroper.com, ARIKROPER.
Yeah.
And so from me and Maja to all of you out there, keep your minds open.